If you agree that it's more important to be factually accurate than politically correct, visit IBDeditorials.com today. From global warming and healthcare to the war on terror and Iraq, we expose the myths promoted by the mainstream media. Get today's commentary, cartoons, and podcasts from Investor's Business Daily, exclusively on IBDeditorials.com.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Dennis Prager Show. We really do. We talk about everything in life. One of the most interesting questions of American history is, has America been isolationist as a general rule? And then finally, when we got a lot of power, perhaps at the end of the 19th century, then all of a sudden we became interested in foreign affairs. Have we been in any way directed by some higher noble cause, or is this a nation like every other nation? These are the questions that are discussed in a new book called Dangerous Nation by a major thinker, Robert Kagan. Robert Kagan is a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and a columnist at the Washington Post. Again, the book is Dangerous Nation, America's Place in the World from Its Earliest Days to the Dawn of the 20th Century. And it's not daunting academese. It's actually written in English. Robert Kagan in Brussels, Belgium. Welcome to the Dennis Prager Show.
Thanks very much.
Well, what is in, I generally do this with authors, and I'll do it with you. Tell us in a nutshell the thesis of your book.
Well, the thesis of the book, which you kind of approached in your question at the beginning, is that the United States, far from being an isolationist power naturally, either in its infancy or later, has in fact always been an expansive and expansionist power. We all know that the United States was territorially expansionist for much of its history. But it also, because of its ideology, has always taken an interest in affairs around the world, always been shaped by its view of universal rights and universal principles, and that, together with its growing power, explains how we got to where we are today.
Let me ask you in a very direct way, if there is a left and a right reading of American foreign affairs historically, the left reading is the United States has been a materially acquisitive power and increasingly, in fact, an imperial power, just primarily looking out for great economic benefits for itself. The right reading, that is capital R, I'm not saying correct reading, the right reading has generally been that as much as America would love, like any other place, to be economically successful, the primary reason for its intervention in foreign places has been an idealistic one. Which are you closer to?
I'm closer to the latter. I think especially in the 20th century, but also in the 19th century, its involvement overseas has usually been driven by idealistic motives, including most prominently the desire to see liberalism, here with a small L, succeed abroad as it has in the United States. Now, that's not to say that material interests have played an important role in American foreign policy, especially in the early period. It was material interests that drove settlers across the continent, pushing out of the way whoever happened to be on the land that they wanted. There's no denying that, and Americans have always been interested in making money overseas. But that is also an aspect of liberalism, you know, because the liberal worldview from people like Adam Smith and other Enlightenment thinkers is that, you know, that is what brings progress, and that's also what brings human dignity, and ultimately that's what brings freedom, is the right to pursue those kinds of opportunities.
I suspected, having read a lot of the articles you've written, I have not yet read this book, which I intend to read, and I don't say that to all the authors I have on. I can't. I would be dishonest. It's not possible. But what strikes me as fascinating, if I may go outside your book for a moment, is that you believe that we have largely been animated by idealism, and I believe that as well, in our foreign policy, especially our military interventions. And two things. One, you're with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. That is not a viewpoint I tend to associate with that group. And two, you're published by Knopf, which it generally doesn't publish works with this view. How do you explain your success in those two arenas?
surprising and welcome open-mindedness in both institutions is the only answer I can give. I mean, you know, Carnegie does not generally advance the worldview that I have, but I have to say that the president of Carnegie and the endowment have been wonderful. I've been there for 10 years, so you have to give them credit at least for genuine open-mindedness.
And the same with Knopf. Again, it's not a book that I would have associated with that publisher, which is the one of the preeminent publishers, obviously, in the country, and generally publishes works left of center. Now let's analyze this. Then, you believe that in the Declaration of Independence begins is in effect the battery that charges our foreign policy.
That's right. I mean, we are a different nation than all other nations in history, in that our very nationhood comes from the universal principles that are spoken of and exalted in the Declaration of Independence. An American is not an American because by blood or because they were born there, because obviously so many Americans were not born in the North American continent. A Frenchman is a Frenchman because he's born there, speaks the French language, has French parents. But an American is American because they adhere to these ideals in the Declaration, and those ideals are universal. Americans from the beginning believed that they were speaking the truth. They were really admitted of no alternative truths, that all men are created equal and have the rights that the Declaration speaks of. And that is what binds Americans together, and it makes America inherently internationalist. This is, I think, the great irony. We're supposed to be isolationist, but our principles make us inherently internationalist.
How do you account, then, for the general read of the more isolationist crowd, which was conservative in the mid-20th century and earlier part, and is now on the liberal side, the more isolationist? Their defense is often the George Washington farewell address about warning about entangling alliances.
Well, that and other things, the Monroe Doctrine and various statements made by various Americans over the years. There's a great myth that that Americans have clung to in many respects, both left, right, and center, which is that at our birth we were isolationist. But that really is, I mean, what I've attempted to do in this book, Dangerous Nation, is to really show what Americans were like in that period and to put things like Washington's Farewell's Address and the Monroe Doctrine in the context and show what they really meant, the authors of those two statements. Washington was giving the people of his nation advice based on the premise that America would eventually be one of the great powers of the world. He and Alexander Hamilton, who together wrote the Farewell Address, say many times and make it clear they expected the United States to be a great power, if not the greatest power in the world. What was needed in the meantime, while America was very weak, faced with some dangerous imperial powers like France and Britain, was to hold their fire, stay out of trouble, and as Washington says, in a certain amount of time, maybe 10 years, maybe 20, the United States would be able to, as he put it, bid defiance to the greatest powers on earth. And really, the Farewell Address was a temporary warning, not a permanent statement of what American foreign policy should be.
Right. It was a pragmatic, not an ideological request.
Absolutely. And it was based on the circumstances of the moment. By the way, it was also a political document. He was in the process of trying to make sure that Thomas Jefferson wasn't elected in the election of 1796, and the Farewell Address is really aimed at supporters of Jefferson who would bring us too close to France and too far from Britain.
Very interesting.
On the Monroe Doctrine, you know, we think of the Monroe Doctrine as hands-off, stay out of our hemisphere, that's isolation.
Yes, that's right.
When the Europeans saw the Monroe Doctrine, they thought it was one of the most audacious power grabs in the history, in their recent history.
Well, actually, I just need to question you. I never understood the Monroe Doctrine as isolationism. I to say that the entire Western Hemisphere is under our protection is hardly isolationist.
Well, you're quite right, but I have to say you understand this very clearly, but you'd be surprised, or maybe you wouldn't be surprised, at how many people say this is all part of the isolationist tradition.
No, that is funny, of course, because it's so it's an enormous area to be concerned with for an isolationist power.
And the European powers of the day thought, who is this relatively weak,
yes, exactly,
North American continent to say that the whole hemisphere belongs to it? It was also a highly ideological document, which is something that I think also people don't know well, which is, you know, the real separation that Monroe was talking about was a separation between the old world monarchies and the new republics that he hoped would be springing up in the Western Hemisphere.
All right, we'll be back in a moment. The author of this important book is Robert Kagan, the important book Dangerous Nation. When we come back, I'm going to ask him about what the higher motivations were for many of our military interventions. Were they imperialist or were they idealistic? This is Dennis Prager. We return. You're listening to the Dennis Prager Show. My guest is Robert Kagan, the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, Washington Post columnist, and his book, Dangerous Nation. It's about America's place in the world. Why have we intervened so much? A, we were never isolationist. And B, why have we intervened so much in world affairs? And his audacious thesis, which I fully support, is that whatever other reasons there were, the primary one emanates from the founding of our country, that there was an idealism about the American role in the world. And I'm curious then, Robert Kagan, how do you react to the dominant, and it is the dominant explanation of American wars and American foreign policy in our universities, that it is just another empire out for power?
Well, the explanation, I think, is that the most prominent historians of American diplomatic history who arose in the 1960s were influenced, as we all historians are influenced by what's going on around them, were influenced by the Vietnam War and their opposition to Vietnam. And that tremendously shaped, I think, their view of the entire American history as they sought the roots for it. And because Marxism of various varieties was so prominent at that time in among these academics, they chose a basically Marxist interpretation, which was that it was the fulfillment of capitalism. It was really what Lenin wrote, that empire is the highest stage of capitalism, imperialism is the highest stage. And so that was pretty much their thesis, and it took hold. Why it took hold as widely as it does, even people who don't consider themselves on the left think that this is the explanation. I mean, my favorite example of this distortion is really the Spanish-American War of 1898, where it's almost everybody thinks that this was an imperial grab. It was about money. It was about capitalists and investments. It was about the Asian economic empire. And the truth is, as I put out in the book, it was a humanitarian intervention led by people on the left in America, but widely supported across the entire political spectrum, to help the poor, suffering Cuban people get out from under this terrible tyranny of Spain. And that was the motive for our intervention in Cuba.
How does the left explain that war?
Well, purely economics. The business groups somehow got us into the war. Of course, everybody knows the business groups were the great opponents of going into Cuba, actually, because they were worried about its effect on their investments. But then the next answer is, well, even though they weren't arguing for it, somehow underneath the table they were. That is the explanation. And also to acquire bases in the Philippines, which would allow us to pursue a commercial empire in Asia. None of which is the real explanation.
And why were we in the Philippines?
By accident. You know, when we went to war with Spain, there were plans that had been on the shelf for about 50 years, going back to the 1850s, what do we do if we get into a war with Spain? Well, Spain had a navy in the Atlantic and in the Pacific, as at this point did the United States. And if you're going to war with them, you had to go to war with them in both oceans. So we all remember Admiral Dewey defeating the Spanish Navy. And the next thing you know, America has got the Philippines on its hands. And William McKinley was trying to decide what to do, and he thought it would be irresponsible either to turn them over to their own selves, because he believed, as many people now say about Iraqis, that they weren't ready for democracy and it would be chaos and anarchy and slaughter. So he didn't like that option. Another option was turn them over to Germany, turn them back to Spain, turn them over to somebody else. That didn't seem right. So the United States undertook what turned out to be a quite thankless task of trying to sort of prepare the Philippines for independence, which unfortunately led to a very strong anti-colonial movement, quite understandable, which led to a very bloody four-year war.
The way I was taught it, I remember the famous or infamous story of William McKinley saying he couldn't even, if you looked on a globe, he couldn't find where the Philippines were.
Yeah. I mean, if you listen to the left revisionists, the prominent historians who dominate our textbooks, Philippines was all part of the plan. In fact, it was the plan. But, of course, I think you could hardly find anyone before the war who was thinking about acquiring the Philippines.
I asked Howard Zinn, the most widely read historian on college campuses, on this program, and I published the transcript in my column when it happened, and I asked him if the United States had never existed, would the world be a better or worse place? And he said it would have been a better place.
Yeah.
This is the dominant thinking on campus these days.
Well, it's the dominant teaching. I'm not sure, I don't know that all the students are necessarily swallowing that view, but I know that his book is, a constant bestseller and people enjoy reading it. But I'll tell you one thing that's ironic. For all the sway that these left revisionist historians have had in the academy, they've had no real impact on the actual foreign policy of the United States. And in a way, they haven't even had a really good any powerful impact on the way people think about American foreign policy.
Well,
I mean,
forgive me. How do you say that in light of the power of the idea that we are in Iraq for oil?
First of all, I think that that is still only a fraction of the population that believes that. But in any case, I'm not talking about what people believe at any given moment. I'm talking about the actual policies of the United States. You would think, listening to the debate today, that only George Bush could ever possibly have done these kinds of things. But we know perfectly well that the Clinton administration was also interventionist, also went to war with Iraq. There's enormous continuity in American foreign policy. If a Democratic president is elected in 2008, their foreign policy will not be that, I predict, will not be that different from the foreign policy that's been pursued by this administration and recent administrations. I mean, one thing that I've seen at looking over American history is the forces that move the United States in the world are more powerful than any individual and more powerful. These debates have gone on for 200 years, but America continues to move in a pretty steady direction.
And that is of trying to spread our values.
That's right, spread our values, spread our influence. If you really look for all the debates about isolationism and every war has been hotly debated, the one consistent thing over 400 years of American history, going back even before the Revolution, is a continual expansiveness. The United States becomes more and more deeply involved in more and more corners of the world. The most striking thing, I think, is after the end of the Cold War, when you would think, with the disappearance of the Soviet Union, a truly isolationist America would have come back home, right? Instead, we expanded NATO, we got involved in Central Asia. This is the general thrust of American foreign policy.
The important book is Dangerous Nation, the author Robert Kagan. Take your questions. If you disagree, for example, you think America really has been animated by material concerns, not by idealism? Give us a call, 1-8-PRAGER-776, The Dennis Prager Show. You're listening to The Dennis Prager Show, and I welcome you back. Robert Kagan is my guest. Very important book. And it puts in with tremendous authority, and he is widely recognized across the spectrum as a serious historian. And he advances the thesis with the facts that the United States has been impelled by idealistic motives in its foreign policy far more than imperialist motives, or economic motives alone. The book is, again, Dangerous Nation. Robert Kagan is the author. Let's take some calls. from around the country, beginning in Los Angeles, California. Paul, you're on with Robert Kagan and Dennis Prager. Hi.
Good morning, gentlemen. It's an honor to speak with you. My point of disagreement was I actually lived in the Philippines for 3 years and studied a bit on history and also looked through congressional records. And I have to say that during that period of time, at the turn of the century, soldiers were extremely aggressive in terms of torture tactics against the local population. And even congressmen were asking about things like, you know, is there a lot of gold in the land? Are you finding, you know, natural resources? So I do think there was a dimension of exploitation that went along with our occupation of the Philippines under McKinley.
Robert
Kagan?
That
was my point of disagreement.
Right. Robert Kagan?
Well, we were talking earlier about why the United States wound up in the Philippines, and I was only emphasizing that no one was particularly expecting to end up in the Philippines, much less having a plan for its exploitation. The caller is absolutely right. The four-year counterinsurgency war that the United States fought against the Filipinos was very brutal. We were fighting up a very determined independence force led by Aguinaldo. And the American soldiers were, you know, really one of the first times they'd been involved in something like this, and they were in many respects very brutal. I don't know, congressmen, if the United States is in that position, there's some congressmen always asking if there's any money to be made somewhere. People are always asking about that. I think they were all quite disappointed. I don't think the Philippines was a big economic bonanza for anybody. And my only point was that was certainly not the motive that led the United States into the Philippines.
Does that answer you, Paul?
Yeah, I think that's a fair response. And I would agree that I think our country is more a force for moral good in the world than not.
Right. All right. I thank you very much. And let's go to stay on the West Coast, Sherman Oaks, California. Alan, hello, Alan. Dennis Prager and Robert Kagan.
Yes. Well, the point he said earlier that we didn't return to the isolationism of pre-World War II, of course, during the Depression prior to World War II, we had no great military-industrial complex to support. After World War II, there was that industry, and it was not going to devolve and go away, especially since we had to nurture the atomic energy, the weapons, and development of atomic energy. And so we had to, as President Eisenhower warned us against, we had to watch the military-industrial complex. The Cold War was an excellent device in order to keep expanding it and grabbing more and more tax money for military-industrial purposes.
Okay, let's get a response on that.
Well, that analysis I really don't agree with. For one thing, the United States was perfectly capable of building up forces as it did. There was a great naval buildup in the 1880s and 1890s. It was not driven by any industrial complex. It was in a time of peace. It was driven by the desire of the United States to wield more influence. After the Second World War, the rise of these defense industries was driven by the demand coming from the government, which people like Dean Acheson, George Marshall, Harry Truman, believed that with World War II ended, the United States had the critical role to play. There was no one else who could play the role of A, keeping the general peace, B, resisting the Soviet Union. The American defense budget on the eve of the Korean War was about $18 billion. Dean Acheson, in a famous national security directive, participated in calling for upwards of $50 billion. That came once the Korean intervention, once the North Koreans invaded the South. So it was driven by policy. I don't at all accept the thesis that the so-called military-industrial complex is able to foment foreign policies which feed it. It's quite the other way around.
We'll continue. When we come back, I want to ask about how these ideas caught on, that the United States is a force, has been a force for evil, is just another imperial power. It's what I learned when I was at the School of International Affairs at Columbia. That's how they taught the Cold War to me. Just two superpowers in battle for power. Not a battle of freedom versus totalitarianism. The book, Dangerous Nation. You're listening to the Dennis Prager Show. Hi, everybody. Dennis Prager here. I'm speaking to Robert Kagan. The recently published Dangerous Nation is the subject. Dangerous Nation, America's place in the world from its earliest days to the dawn of the 20th century. It is so important. It's an antidote to what your kids are learning, and it's written by a major historian. It's an antidote to what they are studying in college. Now, let me talk to you now about the larger issues that all of the facts that you bring in your book raise. For example, you debunk the notion that we were ever isolationist, but there have always been isolationist forces in American public life. Generally speaking, taking the 20th century, and your book only goes up to the dawn of the 20th, but obviously it's an area you know very well. Is it fair to say that isolationism, to the extent that it has existed, was for the first part of the 20th century more to be found on the right, and in the second half of the 20th century, or at least after Vietnam, to be found on the left?
Well, it's been first of all, let me say I'll have a second volume coming out, which covers the rest of covers the 20th century and up to into the 21st century. So I will be addressing these issues.
I know that. Yeah.
It's been found on all kinds of sides, but I generally, with one exception, I generally associate the isolationist tendency. And you're right; it's always been there's always been people arguing for this view. I generally associate it with small c conservatism. And one of the reasons is that historically, just as most conservatives favor a small government, they've always understood that a big foreign policy tends to lead to big government. It generally increases the power of the federal government. Back at our, I know you asked about the 20th century, but just let me go back for a second. When our Constitution was being debated, and you had Hamilton and Washington and Jefferson and Madison on one side, you had people like Patrick Henry on the other, warning that the Constitution would lead to empire, as he put it. That concern has animated people like Robert Taft, who was the great Republican isolationist in the late 30s and 40s, who was worried that America would be meddling in everybody's business and it would somehow lose its democratic soul in the process. In the 20s, it was more a Midwestern progressive movement. People like Borah and others of those famous isolationists were actually sort of progressives who had gone toward isolationism. It's shifted parties. In the late 19th century, it was Democrats who were the most isolationist, and in the middle of the 20th century, it was mostly Republicans.
All right, so that generalization that I made has some accuracy.
I think it does. I think that generally, you know, it's more liberal, progressive foreign policy, and when I say progressive, I mean people like Teddy Roosevelt, who generally believe in the power of the federal government at home and the power of the United States overseas. And it's generally opponents of that progressive view that oppose interventionism overseas.
Well, is there then an inherent conflict to what we consider to be conservative, more or less today, smaller government and yet an activist foreign policy?
Yes. I mean, it's been an anomaly in terms of American history, although it's been a long anomaly, because I think where things got turned around was during the Cold War, when conservatives, for a lot of reasons, joined the anti-communist, you know, they were, in fact, the core of the anti-communist movement. But anti-communism meant resisting the Soviet Union. Resisting the Soviet Union meant resisting it everywhere and resisting communism everywhere. And, you know, if you look at the origins of people like Ronald Reagan, it wasn't surprising that Ronald Reagan was a great internationalist who believed that America had a mission everywhere in the world to try to promote democracy and fight against communism. You know, he learned that view during the Cold War. I remember a time in the 1980s when I was working in the Reagan administration, people like Pat Buchanan were talking about the need to spread democracy everywhere in the world. Then the Cold War ends, and I think the conservatives become divided, and I think we can see those divisions today. There's a lot of conservative opposition, people like Bill Buckley, obviously Pat Buchanan and others, who claim that the real conservative tradition is being violated by George W. Bush and by this, what they conceive as this cabal of neoconservatives, because they say, people like George Will say, the true conservative tradition is not about that kind of global role.
Didn't George Will, though, support the Iraq War?
Well, that's a bit of a complication. I mean, for George Will, I think he supported it very, very, very virulently. And I remember George Will writing, and I actually went back to look at one of these columns. He was very big, even in the 1990s, on promoting democracy overseas. He was glad we overthrew Noriega precisely to promote democracy in Panama in 1989. But I think he's right today to say that that is not a conservative foreign policy. I think he departed from true conservatism when he, at least his version of conservatism, when he went in the direction during the Cold War.
Which you would identify with Robert Taft.
Which, people always demonize Robert Taft because he just happened to oppose the fight against Hitler. But if you go back and read what he wrote then and the speeches that he gave, you could use them word for word, what many people are saying in opposition to Iraq today, both conservatives and liberals. He was making the usual core argument against this kind of interventionism, that it would make America the boss of the world, a meddler. I think he called it, I can't remember, Meddling Maggie or something like that, and that it was going to have a negative effect on the nature of our democracy at home.
I'd like to have you on just to discuss Iraq, so I won't even pursue that now. It can't be done. It can't be done in a minute. But as a final question, what can be done to help teach Americans that we have been animated by idealism? It's terrible. What is the view of America that is dominant in the elite is terrible.
Well, I totally agree, and unfortunately, what needs to be done is something that's very difficult to do. And I'm sure you're more than you probably have talked about this many times. Is you've got to start in colleges and the academies, and you've got to raise young professors and somehow get them jobs when they're being closed out by this dominant view, because that's what filters down into the high schools and into the elementary schools.
Normally, I reserve the last segment of a couple of minutes to myself, but I want to get your answer. So this is a credit to you. I want to get your answer to one more question, which I will pose to you when we return. I'm speaking to Robert Kagan. Dangerous Nation is the book. I'm Dennis Prager. Dennis Prager here. And as I said earlier, I normally reserve the last couple of minutes to some thoughts on the subject in an interview with an author. But in this case, I have such a pressing question I want to pose to Robert Kagan, author of Dangerous Nation, and that is this. You make this compelling case, historically based, that American intervention in the world has been largely driven by idealism, not by imperialism or economic self-interest. While the economic factor is not negligible, obviously. But what I want to hear from you is how and why that differs from Europe.
Oh, well, I mean, it differs from Europe's long history. There have been very little kind of idealism in much of Europe's wars over the centuries, unless Nazism counts as idealism. I don't think it does. The French in the Revolution back in the late 18th century were inspired by, theoretically, by the idea of the Declaration of Rights of Man. But Napoleon pretty much put an end to that, and then it was really just a war for expansion. Today, the Europeans are motivated by a different set of views, which has more to do with their sense of world peace and international order. They are not particularly motivated by any ideal of spreading, certainly using their power to spread liberal ideals. In fact, they spend most of their time worrying about the United States doing that these days.
And the reason?
The reason is because the United States is unique.
Right, I agree. And the reason?
The reason is because our nationalism is based on ideals itself. There is no America without American ideals. That's not true of any European country. And I think that that's what makes us a great nation. It's what's made us great throughout history, and I think it's what makes us great today.
Robert Kagan, more power to you. I look forward to talking to you often in the future.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. The book is Dangerous Nation. It's self-recommending, as you heard. About 1 minute, less than a minute, to tell you this. Yes, we have been unique. You want to prove it in terms of our foreign policy? Why we have intervened for idealistic reasons, you read a book like Dangerous Nation. And why have we been different from all other nations? Because we have been animated by something that transcends sheer politics. And that has not been true of Europe or any other civilization. And that ultimately emanates from a religious impulse. And that is the great battle that we face in the United States today? Should we maintain the essential religious idealistic nature of this country, or should we go the way of Europe and be another secular state? That's the question. That's what the Civil War is about. That's what I'm fighting. You're listening to The Dennis Prager Show.